And now we can actually talk to my colleague who's in my team here, Aaron Gustafson, the son of Gustav, actually. If you're wondering, he has not lost a bet. That's just the way he likes his shirts. And we're talking about accessibility right now and how the web should just work for everybody. And that's a big topic for all of us here, as we can see with the descriptions and everything. So you're going to build on top of what Andy has told us, but more on a more holistic approach in design and development. I guess what we're doing. This is the only talk I haven't seen yet, so I'm going to be as surprised as you are.
Indeed. All right. Bear with me for one moment here.
It's a bit of a setup because there's going to be audio in there as well.
Yeah. So let me just. Hopefully that's. Hopefully you're picking up that audio in the back from the headphone jack there. Can I get a thumbs up if you are? On the board.
The cable says audio, so that should be good.
Yeah, I'm plugged in on the headphones. I'm going up and down.
By the way, if you also have a MacBook and you always have that horrible sound when you change the sound of your of the volume, if you press Option, it doesn't make the sound. So all your colleagues will love me now after you've done that. Dun, dun, dun.
So sound, I had it not going out through, it's going out through headphones.
Can we put a microphone on top of your speaker, maybe?
I mean, that might be the other option. Is there another mic hiding in here?
No.
I'll just lean in when it comes to. All right, let's see. Oh, there is audio in there. It's making noise. Let's see. No? Still not
hearing
anything.
That is weird.
That is really strange. All right.
You could leave my microphone here and hold that over your speaker later.
That's true. Oh. All right, we'll try one more time. Won't blow your eardrums.
Nope.
Nope, still nothing. All right.
The microphone?
All right, we'll do that.
There's always a hardware way to solve these kind of problems. It doesn't make a sound at all.
That's weird. All right. Let me try disconnecting and going in straight at HDMI. Maybe it's the plug. Bear with us for one moment here. All right.
Interoperability, accessibility, all these kind of things.
Yep. All right, so I'm not hearing any audio on my computer at all now.
No.
Ah, fun. All right. No, it's not going out to HDMI or anything.
It seems to be the computer.
Yeah.
We're not going to blame any companies, but it seems to be the computer.
All right, I'll give you your mic back then.
Okay.
You can mute Christian again in a moment. All right. How many times I want to say that? All right, so thankfully the audio shouldn't be too important for this. I can describe a lot of what's going on in it. But hi, my name is Aaron Gustafson. I work at Microsoft working on web standards and accessibility advocacy. And I'm going to talk to you a bit about accessibility today. So I get my so many technical difficulties. There we go. All right, so we as an industry, I would say, tend to have a fairly myopic view of experience. Those of us who work day to day in accessibility probably have a broader perspective than most, but I'd argue that even we fall short now and again when it comes to seeing the web as other people do. I'm of course here to talk to you about accessibility. And if you're like most audiences that I talk to, I'm guessing when you hear the word accessibility, you probably think screen reader. And that's okay. Screen readers are certainly one part of the assistive technology spectrum. But my hope is that by the end of this talk, when somebody says the word accessibility to you, you instead think about opportunity. So accessibility is concerned with accommodating disabilities, but our understanding of what a disability is has changed very much over time. In the 1980s, the World Health Organization defined disability as a personal attribute, having to deal with health conditions. Sorry, my clicker is apparently dying. There are all sorts of problems. They've since updated that definition to be about disability, to have disability be defined more contextually, to be more context dependent. The point of interaction between a person and society is where disability happens. And it's our responsibility to know how our design affects those interactions. If we use our own abilities and biases as a starting point, we end up with products designed for people of a specific age, language, technical ability, physical ability, maybe certain assumptions about their access to income, their ability to have a certain amount of time, or even the speed of their network connectivity. When it comes to people, there's no such thing as normal. For example, the interactions we design with technology depend heavily on what we can see, hear, say, and touch. And if we design with ourselves as the baseline, we can overlook the circumstances that affect people we can overlook people who have different circumstances than ours. I love exercises that create opportunities for revelation. And one of my favorites originates from John Rawls, the gentleman you see here. Rawls was a philosopher who used to run a social experiment with students and church groups and the like. And in that experiment, the participants were allowed to create any sort of society that they wanted. It could follow any philosophy. It could be a monarchy, it could be a democracy, it could be anarchy, it could be capitalist, it could be socialist. And the people in this experiment had free rein to control every aspect, every facet of that society. And then he'd add in the twist. They couldn't control the position they themselves would occupy in that society. So this twist is what John Harsanyi, who's an early game theorist, refers to as the veil of ignorance. And what Rawls found is that time and time again, when he would run this experiment, the individuals participating would gravitate towards creating the most egalitarian societies possible. Now, this makes complete sense, because what rational, self-interested human being would treat the elderly, the sick, people of a particular gender, race, creed, or color poorly if they could find themselves in that very same position? We're often told that accessibility is only concerned with the folks with, quote unquote, special needs. Well, newsflash, we all have special needs, right? Some we're born with, some we develop, some are temporary, some have nothing to do with us personally but are more situational, or maybe purely dependent on the hardware that we're using, the interaction methods we have available to us, or even the speed at which we can access the internet or process data. Sometimes disability is a temporary thing. A short-term disability or a short-term injury or an illness can affect the way people interact with the world around them. Looking into a bright light, like the ones up here, can cause a temporary vision impairment. Being sick with a cough makes it hard to speak. Wearing a cast can limit your ability to lift an everyday object. And on the more technical side of things, small touch screens can be awkward to interact with if you're fat-fingered like I am. Glossy screens can be difficult to read in a glaring light. Low contrast text can be difficult to read when you turn the screen brightness down in order to save some of your battery on your mobile device. And recognizing that we all have special needs leads us to make better decisions as designers and developers. When we understand that disability is a universal and dynamic way of interacting with the world, it can become something else as well, a source or an inspiration for our creativity. Our impact can also expand as our inclusive designs reach a greater number of people. Designing for people with permanent disabilities can seem like a significant constraint, but the resulting designs can actually benefit people in many other walks of life. For example, curb cuts in sidewalks were first created to make it easier and safer for people in wheelchairs to cross the street. But curb cuts also help people in a wide range of other circumstances, from kids riding bicycles, to parents pushing strollers, to people hauling heavy equipment, riding skateboards, and the like. Similarly, high contrast screen settings were initially made to benefit people with vision impairments, but today, many people benefit from high contrast settings when they use a device in bright sunlight. Same is true for remote controls, automatic door openers, voice controls, and much more. Designing with constraints in mind is simply designing well. By designing for somebody with a permanent disability, someone with a situational disability can also benefit. So, for example, a device designed for a person who has one arm could also be effectively used by somebody who maybe has a broken arm, a temporary disability, or maybe just a new parent who happens to be holding an infant, which is a very situational disability. And being mindful of the continuum from permanent to situational disabilities helps us rethink how our designs can scale to more people in new ways. So in the US, 26,000 people a year suffer from a loss of an upper extremity. But when we include people with temporary and situational disabilities, that number skyrockets to over 21 million people. This creates a lot of opportunity to reach those people. Now, as a web design philosophy, progressive enhancement, which I'm a huge advocate for, is right in line with this egalitarian, inclusive design approach. It calls for equality of opportunity, but doesn't require equality of outcome. In other words, everybody needs to have access to something, but we don't expect them all to have the same exact experience and the same end result. It's okay for different folks to experience your products in different ways, as long as everyone can accomplish the task they set out to do. Or as Ben Ho eloquently put it, progressive enhancement keeps the design open to the possibilities of sexiness in opportune contexts, rather than starting with a whole experience that must be compromised. At its essence, progressive enhancement is all about being good designers. So the definition of design is actually to devise for a specific function or end. Classically, it means to indicate, and it comes from the medieval Latin designare, which means to mark out. So as Jeff Veen astutely observes in this quote, there's a lot of bad design out there that is more concerned with aesthetics than problem solving, but design is ultimately about problem solving. When we're concerned with the user interface, it can sometimes, it can sometimes come at the expense of the user experience. So here we have the beautiful coffee pot for masochists by Jacques Carlman, which is beautiful, but completely unusable. This was famously referenced by Don Norman in Emotional Design. But it's possible to have something that's both beautiful and highly functional. This is the ramp embedded in the stairs of Robson Square in Vancouver, BC. 24 Ways is an advent calendar for web professionals. It's a magazine of sorts, but it's also highly interactive and accessible. So there's a lot of interesting things that are going on, a lot of animations, just a lot of really neat stuff that they're taking advantage of here. Now, the site's developers employ a handful of features from ARIA, the Accessible Rich Internet Applications spec, in order to increase the accessibility of this site. One such feature they use is ARIA landmarks, which identify key areas of a page, such as the primary header or banner of the site, the main content, the content concerned with easing navigation of the site, or even information about the content, such as the copyright designations. And users browsing with ARIAware screen readers can use these landmarks to quickly navigate through the document. And this example hints at a simple reality. Oop.
Navigation landmark browse 24 ways heading level 1.
Finally got audio.
Landmark search 24 ways. Content info landmark copyright 2005-2006.
So I don't know if any of that came through, but basically the screen reader will read out when you go into landmark mode all of the different landmarks that you can encounter, and you can move from landmark to landmark through the document. So this example hints at a simple reality, which is that every interface is a conversation. We engage our users directly in an effort to inform them, to entertain them, or persuade them to act in a particular way. And how this conversation goes directly affects the experience our users have. Now, this may sound great as a quote to share on Twitter, feel free. It's absolutely true, though. And it's going to become even more important that we pay attention to this conversation as personal assistance, you know, assistive technology, it's right there in the name, begins to play a larger role in our users' lives. We need to consider the experience when our products are stripped to their essence, when there's no visual design to entice our users to overlook the fundamental flaws in our interfaces, when there's no UI to help them manage the cognitive load of accomplishing a given task. Considering this now will put you way ahead of your competition. and empower your users to do more with your products. It can seem like a daunting task when we spent so much time fixating on how to enable our users to accomplish key tasks on a screen, especially in a responsive context. But what is responsive design about, if not accessibility? Responsive design is concerned with presenting the most appropriate visual experience given the constraints of a screen size. Similarly, conversational interfaces are concerned with the way we communicate with our users, whether there's a screen or not, and whether the user can see it or not. This isn't a new challenge. It's a challenge we've tackled before. If we take a trip back in time to one of the earliest computer games, we had Zork. Zork was written between 1977 and 1979, and it's a text-based adventure game that operates a lot like a game of Dungeons and Dragons, with the program serving the role of the game master. And as you move from location to location throughout the game, the program describes the environment, and it notes objects and people you can interact with. And you can type what you want to do, and then the program will tell you the results of your interactions. As this was the early days of computer gaming, you might think that the interactions would be simple, some sort of simple noun-verb combination like kill troll. But Zork was actually more sophisticated than that. Its parser could understand far more complex commands, like hit the troll with the elvish sword. And this made the experience far more natural, as if you were playing a tabletop game with a friend. Whether Zork or a web page, every interface that we create is a conversation. When I create a home page, I'm talking to visitors as if we've just met. I'm explaining to them what they can do on the site, and in some cases, why it matters. If I'm designing a product page, the conversation goes a little bit different. I'm explaining to my users what a particular object or service is, what it does, and how it can benefit them. I'll skip the BS sales pitch and talk honestly about the product's benefits. If I'm designing a contact form, I want to help my users get a message to me quickly and efficiently. But I also want to set some expectations around how long it'll take me to get back to them, and of course, I'll need to abide by that. Even the humble status update is a conversation. I'm asking a question, and then I'm stepping back and letting my users speak. The floor is theirs. I'm probably mining what they say in order to market to them later, but still a conversation. Conversations consist of words, so it should come as no surprise that we should choose our words carefully. When talking to people, things generally go better if we talk to them like they talk to us. It's a lesson that Facebook learned the somewhat hard way. So back in 2011, over the 2011 holidays, Facebook users were uploading photos like crazy. In the span of a few days, Facebook processed more photo uploads than are contained in the entirety of Flickr. It's a lot of photos. One unintended consequence of this huge deluge of photo uploads was a significant uptick in people asking Facebook to remove specific ones. Facebook received millions of these so-called photo reports, but they made no sense. Moms holding babies reported for harassment, pictures of puppies reported for hate speech, and so on. Roughly 97% of the photo reports were dramatically miscategorized. Facebook's engineers reached out to some of the users who had reported these to get a bit more background regarding the submissions. At the time, the photo reporting tool that they had a list of reasons users could choose from if they wanted a photo removed. But what Facebook discovered was that many of these reports were made for reasons other than those that they offered. And so Facebook's engineers went to work. In some cases, it was because people didn't like the way that they looked in a photo. In others, it was because the photo was of an ex-partner, or maybe it was of a pet that they shared with an ex-partner. And the existing photo reporting tool had not done a good job of accounting for these more personal reasons for wanting a photo removed. So the Facebook engineers added an additional question, another step in the process. And they asked, how does this photo make you feel? And the options were simple: embarrassing, upsetting, saddening, bad photo, other. Now, with this in, oh, sorry, and for the other field, they had a input, if if I can get my clicker to advance. I don't know if my battery's dying or what. There we go. They had an other to provide a free response field to fill in. With this system in place, they found that 50% of the reporters who answered this question chose one of the options that were provided. And that was pretty helpful, but there was still a problem. 34% of the other respondents were writing "it's embarrassing" in the blank rather than choosing the embarrassing option above. So what they realized that was that users weren't identifying with the embarrassing option at the top. Maybe they thought it was referring to them rather than assuming an implied "it's." So they needed to make a subtle shift in the language that they were using. So they changed the label to "please describe the photo." And they updated the options to mirror how people actually talk. "It's embarrassing. It's a bad photo of me. It makes me sad." And what they found is with this subtle change, they were able to increase the percentage of photo reporters who chose one of these options to a whopping 78%. The words we choose matter. Even in something as simple and banal as a form, the words we choose set a tone for our users' experiences and often have an effect on what they do or what they fail to do. The words we choose matter even more in the world of headless UIs. Without any sort of visual aid to help a user see where they are in a form or to aid them in managing the cognitive load of our interfaces, every bit of label and helper text becomes even more important. When Luke Rablewski coined the term mobile first, he told us to focus on the core purpose of each and every page. He was, in essence, telling us to focus on the conversation we're having with our users. And that approach pays huge dividends on small screens. But when it comes to voice-based interactions, the page doesn't really exist. Experience is the sum of each of those individual interactions. As part of their Alexa skills kit, Amazon offers a ton of recommendations for designing for voice, many of which happen to be equally useful for sighted users. First off, write for people. We don't author content for ourselves, we write for others. Right? If what we write frustrated or alienated our users, we've failed at our job. In their profoundly helpful book, Nicely Said, Nicole Fenton and Kate Kieferle offer a bunch of suggestions for how to write with the reader in mind. Be clear, be concise, be honest, be considerate, write how you speak. They also make the recommendation that you should read your work aloud. And as we head into the world of voice-based user interactions, that's beta testing, right? We should avoid technical and legal jargon. When we're writing for our readers, we need to be familiar with their level of domain knowledge so that we don't frustrate or alienate them. For example, if you track error codes in your application, you should send those to your developers, not to the end user. Similarly, we should avoid legalese and use plain language whenever possible. Medium has done a great job of this. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend you read their terms of service. It's beautiful. And they do have one section that's a massive block of all capitalized text, but they actually have a nice soft introduction and explain to you why that's all capitalized and why it's written the way that it's written. It actually helps to frame it much better. When we're requesting feedback from users, we should make it clear that the user needs to respond. Perhaps the most common form example, consider first name. If you just had first name read out to you, what would you think? It's not terribly conversational, right? If you're asking for somebody's first name, why not ask for their first name? So instead of saying that, you could use a label like, "What's your first name?" And then you're making it clear to the user that they need to respond. Yep, see if it picks up another audio here. All right. Similarly, if you have an error in your form or something of that nature, you can notify them of the error and, if possible, give them some clues on how to fix it. Let me actually try. Sorry, bear with me for a moment. I'm going to plug back in just in case the audio gets picked up. Sorry. Just in case, we'll see. Hey, had it and lost it. All right, well, that read out, just so you can see it here. It read out, without your first name, I won't know how to address you. Could you please provide it?
What's your first name?
Yeah, there we go.
Edit text. Without your first name, I won't know how to address you. Could you please provide it?
So that's a much more conversational interface, right? When we're asking a user to choose, we should clearly present the options that we're asking them to choose from. So in the case of radio controls, we want to make sure that those radio and checkbox controls are properly associated with their label text so that this information gets read out appropriately.
Yes, radio button selected.
And you can also use field set and legend elements to group related form controls. This is their whole purpose. You just need to make sure in a context like this, where you're asking a question and then asking them to respond yes or no, that the legend is also focusable so that that content can be read out first.
Do you agree to the terms of service for this site? Yes. Radio button selected. No. Radio button selected.
We should strive for this same sort of clarity when presenting navigation options. The HTML5 nav element enables us to semantically identify an area of the page being used for navigation, but it doesn't always identify that content as navigation when it's encountered naturally in the flow of the document. It is using the role-based navigation we saw earlier, but it doesn't necessarily identify it as such. So for that reason, it can be useful to provide textual introduction to a section, even if you choose to visibly hide that text. You can see that it says class hidden on the H1 here. You might even consider expanding the text of the navigation items to provide additional context, like I do in this example. So here you also see classes of hidden on a bit, and then it just says about, and then hidden is me. So visibly, all you end up seeing is about, or notebook, et cetera.
Here's what you can find on this site. A bit about me. Entries in my notebook.
So NPR has multiple navigation elements in their pages, and they use ARIA to label them without adding any additional tags into that markup. They use the ARIA label attribute to go ahead and provide an accessible label for that text.
Main navigation, navigation landmark list with 5 items, news link.
Super slowed down narrator. He's a little stoned. All right, so prompts should be short while still being clear. So in 1933, in a lecture at Oxford, Albert Einstein famously said, "It can scarcely be denied that the supreme goal of all theory is to make the irreducible basic elements as simple and as few as possible without having to surrender the adequate representation of a single datum of experience." Or as Roger Sessions put it, "Everything should be as simple as it can be, but not simpler." Clear and concise writing is the hallmark of great content and, honestly, good design. And we need to resist the urge of writing for writing's sake. We write in the service of our audience, as I mentioned earlier, not for ourselves. Most of us don't get paid by the word when we do write. Government websites are horrible for this. This is actual text from a government website talking about fire. So heavy rains throughout most of the state have given an optimistic outlook for lessened fire danger for the rest of the season. However, an abundance of lightning maintains a certain amount of hazard in isolated areas that have not received an excessive amount of rain. This could be written much more simply as heavy rains throughout most of the state, I don't know why it keeps jumping, have lessened fire danger for the rest of the season. However, lightning threatens isolated dry areas. Done and dusted. Now, in the UK, the Government Digital Service, GDS, has made great strides in overhauling excruciatingly painful content and making it easier to read and understand. One such example is their overhaul of the accelerated possession process, which allows a landlord to evict a tenant. So the original paper form, which you see a PDF of here, asks for an address like this. The claimant seeks an order of the defendants give possession of, if the premises of which you seek or possession are part of a building, identify the part, flat 3, room 6 and 7, et cetera. Terribly clear, right? And then it requests the type of property concerned, the premises, which is a dwelling house or part of a dwelling house. You know which is which, right? Super clear and to the point. GDS went to work to streamline this, to bring it online, and to make this process, to move it into being more plain language process. And so they asked, what kind of property do you want to take back? A self-contained house, flat, or bedsit? Or room or rooms in a property where tenants may share a kitchen or a bathroom? They then allow you to look up the property or manually enter the address. Now, while it wasn't specifically designed for the future of headless UIs, this form is actually prepared for their eventuality. It's a much more conversational, plain language experience. Looks a lot better, too. We show our users respect by respecting their time, so we should only ask necessary questions. Obviously, straightforward, brief writing is one way we do that, but another is to reduce the time it takes to complete a task. A lot of forms that we create are just brimming with fields to be filled in. In some cases, the vast majority are purely optional or just for our own benefit and not in the benefit of our users. And while it may be easy for users to spot, visual users to spot required fields using the asterisk and such as an indication, bypassing them in an aural interface is actually really difficult. User experience designers have been pushing for simplified forms for as long as I can remember. Users appreciate them, they tend to result in better data, they also tend to convert better than long forms, and when it comes to voice-based interactions, they'll become a necessity. No one's gonna wanna spend 15 minutes working their way through a 15-question registration form when all you need is for them to give you their email address and choose a password. On a similar note, we should avoid slicing fields into multiple parts. For instance, you still see this quite a bit here in the US, asking for a phone number in 3 bits. When someone's interacting with this construct via voice, the user will be required to supply 3 separate values. And in order to do so in an accessible way, each field would require a label. Now, even here, most developers in this room, I would guess, probably only know how to label the first of those 3 boxes. And users are highly unlikely to know what you're asking for when you ask them for their Exchange or central office code and line number. Right? These are not common constructs. HTML5 introduced a lot of new field types that consolidate complex and structured data like phone numbers, dates, times, and such into single fields. So use them. And as an added bonus, in browsers that support it, we actually get validation for free, and we don't need to have extra JavaScript sitting around to do that validation for us. All right. Should also present information in consumable pieces. Like computers, we humans have a finite amount of working memory, and the amount of mental resources required to operate an interface is its cognitive load. When the amount of information that we need to process exceeds our capacity to handle it, we miss important details. We have trouble concentrating, and we become frustrated with that interface. We deal with cognitive load in GUI all the time, but in voice-based interactions, there's no visuals to act as a signpost or to hold the user's hand as they work their way through that interface. That's why it's critical to break complicated tasks down into simpler ones and to eliminate the excess noise, like non-required fields, in very much the same way that Luke told us to do for mobile first. Get rid of the noise, focus on what matters. We can also reduce cognitive load by chunking things like search results and other list type content into smaller groups, asking the user if they want more before we load it in and present it to them. As human beings, we all have special needs. But as designers and developers, it can sometimes be difficult to diagnose potential issues with our products when it comes to accessibility, especially if we don't typically experience that particular need or are unfamiliar with the tools that are used to address it. To that end, my colleagues have been hard at work at making it easier. Man, this thing is just jumping all over the place. My colleagues have been hard at work at making it easier to enhance the accessibility of our products. The first tool I want to talk about is the F12 developer tools in Edge, which Andy talked about not too long ago. And this will be in a forthcoming release of F12. The inspector will actually surface surface accessibility information about each node in the DOM. And if we jump over, this is the forthcoming redesign of HTML accessibility, which is a HTML5 accessibility testing site. And if I inspect the section containing the test results, see if it'll, Man, this thing is just jumping all over the place. Try it again. Video play. If I inspect down, I can look at the section. And you'll see an entire inspector tab dedicated to the accessibility information. Andy also showed us the accessibility tree that was exposed. But using this, we can find information out, such as the accessible name of this particular element, its role that it's playing within the interface, whether it's keyboard focusable or not, various ARIA properties associated with it, and so on. So this becomes a very useful debugging tool for us for being able to figure out issues that we may be having with our websites. And it goes a long way towards helping us to fine-tune our experiences for assistive technology, including screen readers and virtual assistants. Another area where we're doing some work is within Narrator itself. When testing with screen readers, it can be really tempting, as Andy also mentioned, to kind of keep those same tropes of being a sighted user, to leave your screen on so that you can follow along, maybe move your mouse. And that action actually directly prohibits you from being able to experience the site or the application in the way folks with actual visual impairments experience it, or the way people who are in a headless UI scenario do, which can cause you to miss things or make assumptions that something makes sense when, in fact, it doesn't. To help address that, Narrator will soon support developer mode, which Andy demoed, that enables you to blank out a single app, such as Edge or any other application. It could even be one of your installed or hosted apps within Windows, so you don't have any visual access to the UI, but can instead see the information about that particular thing. So again, HTML5 accessibility.
Developer mode enabled.
If I go into developer mode.
Browser results, link, overview, link. Feature support, how to test, link, notes, and further resources.
So the browser window goes blank. It does still read out information to you, at least it does in the build that I have. And the focus caret moves and gives you the text that you can read as a sighted user to be able to see what the information is that's being read out orally in case you keep volume off, as I also typically do. So that's there for diagnostic purposes for you. And the positioning of the caret is also really helpful for when you then come back out of developer mode to be able to identify what element, in case it's not clear to you, which one had focus that you then want to go in and inspect further. So Microsoft is committed to improving accessibility, not only of its own products, but of the web as a whole and of software as a whole. So these tools are just a few of the ways that they're doing that today. Obviously, part of this whole thing is to continue to evolve and improve the accessibility of the web for users browsing in Edge, whether they're using Narrator or other screen readers like JAWS or NVDA. But in addition to that, Microsoft, in partnership with Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, Adobe, AT&T, Dropbox, Facebook, Intuit, LinkedIn, and Yahoo, helped launch Teach Access, which is an effort to address the lack of awareness and understanding about basic accessibility issues, concepts, and best practices in the worlds of CS and HCI education. If successful, which I sincerely hope it is, it should help us address the dire need to have a more accessibility-aware workforce building for both the web and for native software. Similarly, Microsoft Design has shared a fantastic set of resources for improving inclusivity in design. They've created a guide as well as a set of activities you can use to get your team in the accessibility and inclusive design mindset. And then in the not too distant future, we'll be publishing a series of in-depth posts about accessibility on the MS Edge dev blog. These will tackle topics like how we re-architected Edge for better ARIA support and name computation, working with HTML5accessibility.com to improve the test suite that they're using, and how we can enable automated testing in order to discover accessibility regressions before they make it into production. We do this because, with accessibility in mind, we can improve the lives of billions of people, friends, family, neighbors, and complete strangers, all of whom deserve the access and opportunity to use the products that we create, regardless of the different ways that we experience the world. Ultimately, accessibility is not about disabilities or the technologies we use to address them. It's about people. Sure, We'll make it easier for people to look up movie times and purchase tickets to see the latest Transformers debacle, but we'll also empower the nearly 900 million people globally, over 60% of whom are female, that are illiterate by enabling sites to be used purely via voice, even translated in real time into their native language and potentially dialect. We'll create new opportunities for the poor and the disadvantaged to participate in a world that's largely excluded them. You may not be aware, but 80% of Fortune 500 companies, think Walmart, Target, et cetera, only accept job applications online or via computers. We'll enable people who have limited computer skills or who struggle with reading to apply for jobs with these companies. We'll empower immigrants to read lease agreements and postal mail in languages that they don't speak yet. And we'll enable people with visual disabilities to vote even on paper ballots without having assistance from another person. We'll help bridge the digital divide and the literacy gap. And we can create a lot of opportunities for people to better their lives and to better the lives of their families. We have the power to create more equity in this world than most of us have ever dreamed. It's an incredibly exciting time, not just for accessibility, not just for user experience, not just for the web, but for the world. I can't wait to see how awesome you make it. Thank you all very much.